on KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles, public radio for Acadiana.
We're live from the Liberty Theater in Eunice, Louisiana, every Saturday night from 6 to 7:30. Hi, this is Barry Unsley inviting you to join us right here on KRVS for the Rendezvous de Cajun every Saturday night from 6 to 7:30 with great Cajun music, Zydeco, lots of other regional music, stories, commentary, and who knows what else, because we are live from the Liberty Theater in Eunice, Louisiana.
Francomix avec Val, c'est tous les jeudis à 9h sur KRVS.
KRVS Lafayette Lake Charles, now broadcasting in HD radio technology.
Good afternoon. It's 3 p.m. Weather for the KRVS listening area. 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms this afternoon. Partly sunny with a high of around 89 degrees. Calm winds. A 40% chance of lingering precipitation overnight with a low of around 71. 50% chance of rain tomorrow. Currently it's fair and 87 here on the campus of UL Lafayette. Coming up later on this half hour, this hour, we'll be listening to Daryl Borks from the Poets Bookshelf segment. At 4 o'clock, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. We begin by going into the interview studio with Judith Merriweather.
And joining me in the KRVS studios this afternoon is writer Constance Adler. She will be in Grand Coteau this evening at Casa Azul Gibbs for one of their literary evenings. Tonight there will be an oral history presentation, and then Constance will be reading from her memoir called My Bayou, which has just recently been published. So we're so glad to have you here. You're from New Orleans, so you made the trip up and took a little time to stop with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me. Yes, I'm very happy to be here.
Well, tell us about, first of all, tell us about your life. You're not originally from New Orleans, and so that adds a different aspect to a memoir. It's not one coming from five generations of, you know, family living in New Orleans. You fell in love with New Orleans in a way that some people who are natives don't.
Yes, I moved to New Orleans in 1995, and I had been living in New York City. And left because I needed to get out of that city, and had visited New Orleans once and just loved it so much I wanted to try it again and see if it felt like an interesting place that I would want to be. And went for a visit for a week and came back after a week and had already found a new place to live in New Orleans, packed up my apartment in New York and just left. And so it's been 17 years and I still feel like a stranger in a strange land, but it's a really wonderful land. And I actually very much enjoy being a stranger in a strange land, because it gives a real sharpness, I think, to what I'm seeing, and which really feeds my writerly mind.
Well, just the very fact that you picked up from New York City and decided to move to New Orleans would strike many people here in Louisiana as an incredible act of bravery. People in Louisiana don't like to leave, really. They, of course, we have lots of wonderful things here, but that strikes some people as very, would be a difficult decision and would take a lot of courage to do that. So there must have been something about New Orleans that was really drawing you. When you had visited early on your first time coming to New Orleans, what struck you about the city that attracted you?
Well, I think what drew me there is that it really provides everything that is the opposite of what I knew. And mainly, if I could narrow it down, I would say there's a feeling of both slowing things down and also kind of deepening and sharpening the sensual, you know, experiences that I could have there. And it was really the quality of the light, I think, and the sound and the smells. I had been, when I was in New York, I actually had a dream, and this is how I got to New Orleans. And in the dream, a woman spoke to me as I was walking. We were walking down the street in New Orleans with trees overhead, and this woman turned to me and said, "You might become an interesting writer if you move to New Orleans." And I sort of woke up from the dream, not really knowing what to do about it, and just sort of held it at the back of my mind for a couple of years. I mean, it took a while for me to. And when I went back to New Orleans and wandered around, I ended up on Esplanade Avenue, which runs along one edge of the French Quarter. And this was the first time I had seen this street, and first time I had seen the city, actually. And when I stepped onto that street, I recognized it as the street I had seen in my dream a few years earlier. And it just seemed so potent and so rich with significance. I still wasn't sure what this dream woman meant for me to do, but it seemed such a clear signal that's really what pushed me to do this very brave thing, as you say. To me, it just felt like a natural next step, and I've not looked back.
I've not regretted that at all. Mm-hmm. Well, when you first moved here, I mean, you said you got an apartment before you'd headed back to New Orleans, to New York after that week. When you actually settled in, what were your feelings? I guess, again, for those of us who have not moved to a new place like that, making such a break from a home place, what was it like settling into New Orleans? And that was in the mid-90s, I guess.
Right. The thing that I noticed most strongly is how much life happens outdoors, really, and people sitting on their porches, and even though during the summers when it's incredibly hot, there's still a great deal of life on the street, and people just seem to pour out of their houses, and they're very connected to what's going on around them. You don't see that in most cities in the Northeast. People tend to keep more to themselves, and with that increased sort of outdoor life and activity, again, it became an opportunity for me to just learn so much more about the city and absorb a lot of really interesting characters and stories, which eventually came into this book.
People aren't isolated in New Orleans. They do tend to flow into each other.
They really do. No boundaries. It's very watery, you know.
Well, you mentioned in your dream that the woman said you could become an interesting writer if you moved to New Orleans. We should tell people you were a writer before, kind of a journalist,
right.
I guess. What sorts of writing did you do?
I was writing for magazines, and I was writing a lot of what is sort of typical Met magazine stories, although I really enjoyed writing for magazines, personality profiles and things like that. So what I think this dream woman meant for me to do is to shift out of that more journalistic kind of writing, observing and staying out of the story, and really become more immersed in the story. And so I think that's where this much more personal writing started to come from.
Mm-hmm. Well, how long did it take you to write about New Orleans once you moved down?
Well, I started writing for Gambit Weekly, which is our weekly alternative paper, and still writing journalism, but to my great pleasure, I worked with an editor there who, as I often told him, gave me plenty of rope to hang myself. Really getting to write some really fun stories. The first story I wrote for Gambit, I pitched this story as an examination on the nature of confession. And in order to get the material that I needed to write this story, I went down to Jackson Square and sat there with two chairs, one for me and one empty chair, and I hung a banner on the fence in Jackson Square that said, "Confessions Heard Here." And then I just sat there with my notebook and my pen and just waited to see how people would interpret that invitation. And people would come and sit down and ask me about it, and I told them I was writing a story, and I said, "I'm going to write down whatever you confess."
You can't give you absolution.
I don't give absolution. I'm not a priest, but I will listen and take notes and talk about confession with you. And it was just fascinating what what people wanted to confess. It wasn't always confessing something that they had done that they were ashamed of. Sometimes it was a confession of great passion or great love. I said, however you understand that word, you're welcome to tell me. And
How did you explain to them how this was going to appear in an article? Was this going to be public? Would their name be associated? How did you?
I said, I'll use your first name if you want, if that's okay with you. I won't use your last name, and it's going to be in this newspaper. I told them where they could read it, they still wanted to tell me stuff. It's just, I have one of those faces. People want to tell me things.
Unfortunately, on the radio, we can't show that. And would you say that most of the people who sat down with you were tourists from other places? Because in the quarter, of course, there are a lot of people from other states, countries.
You know, I think I had mostly locals. There are a lot of locals who hang out there. Some people from out of town. Most of the people were new. Most of them were, you know, we call them quarter rats. Happy to talk to me.
And not afraid that other people would recognize these confessions.
Right.
So what did you determine about the state of confession, the act of confession? How did you write about it after hearing all these confessions?
Well, I guess what drew me to the story in the first place is that I had this hunch, and it turns out that I was right, just that people really want to be seen. They, you know, and this is not my completely original idea, that there is this incredible urge to get rid of whatever it is you've got hovering in the back of your conscience, and yet there's also this real fear, real nervousness about being exposed, and that there is something very comforting about being seen and heard and sheltered at the same time. And so I wanted to sort of be present with people as they were accepting that invitation to be seen and heard and sheltered. I promised them I wasn't going to judge them, and I wasn't going to expose them, you know, more than they wanted to be. And I kept that promise. And I just thought that I wanted to talk to people about how they feel having confessed something or what that did for them. Because it's a moment of real vulnerability. And people are simultaneously terrified of being vulnerable, and they want to be. And so it's that conflict or that tension that I wanted to observe.
So you would ask them to confess. They would confess or relay something to you, and then you would talk to them about how they felt.
Yeah.
And what kinds of feelings did they have? Was it all very similar, their reaction to having told you personal things? Was that very similar?
Well, I remember this one man I spoke to who talked about his feelings of sorrow that he had abandoned his father. And he didn't really want to, he told me the story, but he didn't want to tell me how he felt about having told me the story. He just wanted to say it and not go any further. And I really, of course I didn't push him, but he just wanted to, it was almost as though he just wanted to listen to it himself in the space between the two of us. And more often than not, I think what I noticed about these folks is just that they were just being really careful with themselves in this moment. And my job was just to let that be, I think, just to sort of assist that carefulness and take notes.
It's like they just wanted to see what it looked like, what shape it took when they actually said
these
words.
Yeah, sometimes you don't know what you're going to confess until someone asks you to, you know.
And if you had to put in categories the types of things people confessed to you, told you, what were basically the different types of stories? Or were they all different?
You know, I think a lot of them were stories about opportunities they had passed up that they wished they hadn't. Whether it was an opportunity to apologize or an opportunity to take some kind of a risk with their lives, or to show love to someone that they wanted to show love to but didn't for some reason. It was a lot of the confessions were the kinds of regrets that we have when we didn't take an opening that had come to us. So
interesting. And what kinds of responses did you get to that article once it was published in Gambit?
Well, people really liked it. I think they were very surprised by it. I think they really were very surprised that I would sit there in Jackson Square. I mean, it's so funny. At the time, it didn't strike me as terribly risky. But later, afterwards, I kind of thought, huh, that was a little bit chancy. I just, you know, walked into it.
I'm sure you were in broad daylight. You weren't sitting in a dark corner.
Of course. But I guess I was making myself pretty vulnerable, too, and didn't even think about it until later.
Mm-hmm. So. Did you encounter any of those people afterwards, since you said some of them were quarter people?
You know, I didn't. I didn't see them. Mm-hmm.
It would be interesting at some point to encounter them and see if that had had an effect and if they actually were able to, having seen what it looked like to say that, actually say it to someone who knew them.
Right.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. If you have just tuned in, my guest is Constance Adler. She is a writer from New Orleans, actually originally from the Northeast, but has fallen in love with New Orleans and has lived there for about 17 years now. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. She will be reading from her memoir tonight in Grand Coteau. The program starts at 7 o'clock. Are you reading first or second? Do you know?
Second.
Second. Someone will be giving an oral history of Grand Coteau first, and then Constance will be reading from her memoir. Has done a lot of journalism, just describing an article that she published in Gambit, the newspaper from New Orleans. So what other kinds of stories about New Orleans did you publish? I mean, that's a fascinating story right there. What were some of your other ideas for stories?
Oh, another story that I did that was a lot of fun was this was the same editor at Gambit who put me up to this. When the census was coming through New Orleans, this was in 2000, I guess. I got a job as an enumerator for the census, and wrote about that experience, about going from house to house to count the people. I mean, that's what we were doing, and that was a really fun story again because I got to meet people under who were at home and not expecting me, and very kind of mixed reactions. What fascinated me about that story was the amount of anxiety there is out there about the census. There's this very strange idea, and I don't know where it comes from, but that the government is somehow going to use this information to invade our privacy. But at the same time, you know, these folks all pay their taxes. You know, there's plenty of information in their tax return, but they're not afraid of filing a tax return. But for some reason, this idea of taking a census arouses in some people a lot of anger. So that was one of the biggest things that came out of that story that kind of puzzled me and fascinated me.
Some leftover from elementary school history classes, or you've heard about they do. Uh-huh. So you wrote an article about that and the reactions of people to you. And how long did you do that job? Just for that 1 year?
Not even a full year. It was just a few months. And then I quit my job and wrote the story.
And you also teach creative writing as well.
Yes.
Not within the confines of a school or a university, but you have personal lessons in creative writing. Describe what kinds of people who have come to your classes.
Well, I teach a workshop. It's a creative writing workshop. And the folks who come to the workshop are, you know, come from all over, and they are varying levels of experience. And the workshop is really open to whoever wants to start writing or keep writing. And so I see people who are working on their novels or working on a collection of short stories or memoirs. And the classes are taught in blocks of 6 weeks, and we meet once a week. And it's sort of it falls into two parts. And the one part is that we have manuscript, a traditional sort of manuscript review. People bring their work in progress, and we share it and take notes and talk about it. And the second part of the class, which is one that I really enjoy very much, is we do writing exercises in class. And I think the thing that I do in this workshop that's a little bit different from other workshops that I've been in is we start with a meditation, a guided meditation. And I lead the students in a meditation. They have to put their notebooks and pens down for a second and just sit and sort of loosen up their hands and close their eyes and sort of drop their thoughts down underneath their thoughts, you know, drop the brain and just sort of get a little bit more settled into a physical awareness. And the guided meditation is geared towards sort of helping them take an inventory of their own bodies from the inside. And then, and that takes a couple of minutes. And then from that, coming out of that meditation, I give everyone a writing prompt, which is usually an image or a phrase or a question that they have to answer. And it really is just to get them past the first sentence. And then the idea is that they just start writing without thinking. Just let the pen lead. And just keep writing whatever comes next, even if it doesn't make sense, even if they have to write the same word over and over and over again. Sooner or later, a new word will come to them, and then something new, and then something new. And it's a timed exercise, and so it usually lasts 10 or 15 minutes. And then we will read whatever we've written at the end of that. And what I like about that exercise is that I really think there's a narrative voice that's kind of buried underneath what I call the mind chatter. You know, there's a storytelling voice that everyone has. I really believe everyone is a natural storyteller, but we sometimes get sort of stopped up from telling our stories because, you know, there's just so much going on, and that usually the only thing that anyone really needs to get to that voice is, again, an invitation to stop, pause, breathe, remember your physical being, and write from that awareness, which is a very stable place, I think. And very, so you're not sort of flying off into the ether with your thoughts. You're writing from a very stable, thoughtful, breathing place. And it's amazing what comes out of those exercises. One woman was my student, told me, and she showed me her notebook afterwards, that she started writing something that was from her own history. She knew about it. It had to do with her and her mother, but it was a style of handwriting she'd never seen before. That she said, I don't know who was writing this story. And I said, well, I'm sure that you were writing this story. She said, but yeah, I've never seen this handwriting before. It was very interesting and very strange. It was a really good story, mm-hmm, too. Mm-hmm.
A little automatic writing, yeah, somebody else taking over.
Or a combination.
Again, if you have just tuned in, my guest is writer Constance Adler, lives in New Orleans, and will be reading tonight in Grand Coteau from her memoir called My Bayou, which has just been published. And I guess we should say that is the bayou of Bayou St. John, which is where you live, nearby where you live. And how has that figured in your time in New Orleans, the bayou?
Well, I've lived near Bayou St. John, I think for about 12 years or so. And and by near, I mean a block or two. And it runs through the center of the city. And I walk there every day. I have a dog, so I have to take him on walks. And I started writing about it because I had reached a point in my evolution as a writer where I wanted to start doing this more personal writing. And I knew I wanted to write something of a book length form. But I didn't have a topic right away. And I was having this sort of thought process, like, what am I going to write about? What am I going to write about? While I was walking around the bayou. And I remembered what one of my writing teachers had told me, which is that, you know, and when you're not sure what to write about, start with where you are. Just start with where you're standing right now. And I was remembering this as I was walking on the bayou, watching my feet, looking down at my feet, watching them press down the grass and the mud of the bayou, and it just clicked. It just sort of had this illumination that I would write about this bayou. And I still didn't know at that point how that was going to look. I just knew that was going to be the organizational principle. And it's a great one because there's a lot of stuff that happens there. It's a busy neighborhood, lots of people, events, things. And so I made the decision that I would document the life around this bayou. And from that, it grew, of course, into a document of my own life, because I'm there a lot. And I think what often happens, and this is sort of practicing what I preach about writing, just following the thread and just letting the narrative voice continue, it became a book about me, to my great surprise.
Well, let's hear a couple passages from My Bayou, again, by Constance Adler, who lives near Bayou St. John in New Orleans.
I was going to read you a few paragraphs from the first chapter, which takes place on Ash Wednesday. And I'm when I was walking around the bayou, picking up the garbage, which I do sometimes, and seeing the pelicans fly by, and being struck by their beauty, and so this is it begins on this Ash Wednesday. As I watched the pelicans soar past me on their giant wings, I marveled at their ability to be at once magnificent and comical. I accepted their benediction and glimpsed the mystery and magic they brought with their wild grace. The birds prompted an unaccountable shift. My feet were literally sinking deeper into the mud where I stood, and yet I also felt myself sinking into something else that didn't have a name yet. The pelicans offered an invitation to descend into this place, to deepen my relationship to my bayou and the city it flowed through. I interpreted this descent, inaugurated at the beginning of the Lenten season, as a call to stewardship. When I saw an aerial photo of the bayou, the pelican's eye view, I was struck by its resemblance to a spinal cord. How intriguing that geography has determined the bayou to be the primitive backbone for this city. It carries the vital spinal fluid that animates the land around it. Bayou St. John is the reason New Orleans exists where it does today. Were it not for the convenient passage between lake and river afforded by this innocuous, muddy trickle, the French explorers who established New Orleans would have gone elsewhere. So we have Bayou St. John to thank for putting us here. When the pelicans came that day in February, Hurricane Katrina wasn't due to arrive for another 6 months. I couldn't have articulated a complete awareness of the threat that loomed over my city, my bayou, my home. Didn't know how soon would come that crashing, fierce storm that brought it all closer to my heart. Yet on that day, I sank into a more encompassing embrace of my home and my role in it. I received my vocation. Some task was called for with urgency not yet apparent. I would document the body enlivened by this spinal cord. My sense of stewardship consisted of a simple assignment: pay attention. I would walk my daily walk along the bayou and see what I could see. Sure, picking up the trash was always a good idea, but my self-appointed job would be to love this bayou by attending to it with my vision and imagination. I would give roundness and shape to whatever transpired here. I would breathe life into this body with my words.
Constance Adler reading from her memoir, her publication that's just come out, My Bayou, New Orleans Through the Eyes of a Lover. I think that's your title there.
Yes.
And I think people from that passage can tell your passion and attention to every detail around you in New Orleans. Constance will be reading tonight in Grand Coteau at Casa Azul Gifts. The program starts at 7 o'clock. Joseph Brooks will be talking first about his life in Grand Coteau, and then Constance will be talking about New Orleans, reading from her memoir. And I'm certain you'll be signing copies. Have you
Yes.
brought books with you?
Yes, I brought books.
Okay. If people are not able to go tonight, where can they find out more information about your writing and perhaps acquire the book?
Oh, I have a website, constanceadler.com. You can learn lots of interesting things there.
Okay. And I think actually I explored a bit and found you had a really interesting little blog called Every Day with Emily.
Emily Every Day.
Emily Every Day.
Yes. Mm-hmm. My visit with Emily Dickinson every morning. Another writing and meditation exercise.
Well, that's a really lovely site as well. So yes, constanceadler.com, and you can find out more about the book if you're not able to attend this evening in Grand Coteau, their literary presentation. It's a free program, open to everyone, in the back of the store. It's a really very sweet vintage store, and if you've never been to Casa Azul, it's a great experience, and you'll find out about the history of Grand Coteau as well as getting to talk with Constance Adler. Thank you so much for coming by today and sharing
with us. Thank you for inviting me. I really enjoyed having this time. Thanks.
Well, we'll look forward to further publications.
Thank you.
pianist Klaus Kaufmann performed Louis Moreau Gottschalk's Ricordati. It's 31 minutes past the hour of 3 o'clock.
It is Thursday afternoon when KRVS presents From the Poet's Bookshelf with Louisiana poet Darryl Bourque, reading works by writers from or inspired by Louisiana.
The first poem today from Improbable Worlds, an anthology of Texas and Louisiana poets, edited by Martha Serpas, is a poem entitled The Sea Chews Things Up by Cleopatra Mathis. Cleopatra Mathis was born and raised in a Greek family in rural Ruston, Louisiana, and she is currently at Dartmouth College, where she directs the creative writing program. She has taught there since 1982. Cleopatra Mathis, The Sea Chews Things Up. When I woke, the waves had gone black, turning over the macerated curd of the ocean bottom, heaving its sludge onto the beach. Some storm far out, I thought, had ravaged the sea, stirred up its bed, sent the whole mess flying to shore. At my feet, I found a grave of starfish, broken and gnarled among the fleshy spines and heads. Every shade of death covered the sand. It looked hopeless in the pale day, but for the birds, a congress of gulls, terns, and the rarest plovers, calm for once, satiated, a measure of one law, this sea will claim it all. Feed them, catch them, grind their complicated bones. In the second poem by Cleopatra Mathis, Salt. All those years I went the way of grief, turning my stony eye on disorder, something to be cleansed and fixed. I was lost, scrubbing away at the hidden, hating the vase where the fruit flies nested, the artful bowl that held ruined fruit. Throw away the rot, I said, making myself saint of the immaculate, not knowing a thing about the soul. Meanwhile, little spirit, essence, psyche, anima, the forever alive but unpinnable one, turned its gaze away, claimed a crack, found a rusty needle, curled up in the eye of it. In the pine floors alone, a million crevices, a million particles of grit, pitch, and crumb. What sea in my bucket could wash the world clean? And who knew the soul was right at home in dust, passing through every incarnation, the tiny breathing mite it entered in the gray swirl under the stove, expelling itself into a draft that carried it into the filmy grease so lightly pocked on the cabinet glass, releasing, floating down, the soul finding one grain of salt lying there under my nose, me at the sink, scouring the porcelain, not seeing.
Join KRVS each Thursday afternoon for From the Poet's Bookshelf with Louisiana poet Darryl Bourque. And with me in the KRVS studios this afternoon are Jeff Albert, Tim Daisy and our own Joseph Butts. And I do say that, Joseph, because you're a KRVS alum and used to have a program here at KRVS.
I am.
And have appeared in our studio many, many times. Jeff, you have, they are all a part of the Jeff Albert Instigation Quartet, and you all will be performing tonight at Cité des Arts at 9:30. So this is a very cool event. It's late at night on a weekday, Cité des Arts.
That's right. You know those jazz musicians will get you in trouble late night on a weeknight.
Absolutely. Well, Jeff, tell us a bit about yourself, first of all, because you are from Lafayette.
Yes, I grew up in Lafayette.
All right.
Went to Como High School.
Okay.
I won't say when, but it was a long time ago.
Yeah, that's always the question. When did you graduate from high school?
It was a while back.
Okay.
And I live in New Orleans now. I've lived in New Orleans. When I left Lafayette, I went to New Orleans.
Okay, and just stayed there and continued making music. Well, were you interested in jazz even in high school? Were you part of like one of the jazz groups
in
high school?
Well, we had the jazz band at Como. Mm-hmm. And actually, the years that I was there, there were a number of musicians who were in the band with me who are still playing. Clint Majan, who plays with Preservation Hall Jazz Band now. Mm-hmm. We went to Como together. And the trumpet player, Graham Breedlove, who plays in the Army Blues now, one of the big military big bands up in D.C. was there when we were there. And the last of the Wooten clan, Charlie, was the bass player in our band.
Right. So. Dear Charlie. Well, that I exactly know how old you are then.
I gave myself away. Right?
Charlie. Well, that was quite a powerhouse back then at Como.
It was. We had a good time. Mm-hmm. We learned a lot.
Mm-hmm. Well, from there, you've gone on to do great things and really interesting music. Tell us about how your sense of jazz has developed over the years. How would you describe your path?
Oh, that's interesting. When I was 18, I wanted to be J.J. Johnson. I was really straight
ahead.
And
that's your instrument.
Yes, I play trombone. Right. Mm-hmm. Really wanted to pursue the straight ahead jazz thing. And I just gradually found other weirder, more interesting ways to approach things. And I had a friend. I had a job at a music store in Metairie, this place called Mitchell's, and a buddy of mine was a piano technician. And so instead of selling sheet music, I would sneak upstairs into his workshop and we would listen to Ornette Coleman records. And I would get in trouble for not being at work, but the Ornette was great. So
you were working.
And so it sort of progressed from there. Mm-hmm. And then I made friends with a trombonist from Chicago named Jeb Bishop. And we had put a group together right after Hurricane Katrina. And so I ended up in Chicago working some with this group and met a bunch of great musicians up there, Tim Daisy being one of them. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of the connection with Tim. Tim showed up at our first Lucky Sevens gig at the Empty Bottle. And I said, hey, I have records that you're on. And I don't know what happened after that, but here we are.
Obviously, he's one of the instigators.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I like that term, instigator, for a number of reasons.
Absolutely. But
yes, Tim's definitely an instigator.
And your instrument, Tim?
I play the drums.
The drums. And so what was your reaction when you first played with Jeff here?
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, a fantastic player. I learned a lot playing with him. Mm-hmm. And I guess the instigation for me to come down here on this particular trip was I often go on tour and you're in cities one night and then the next morning you get up and you leave. Mm-hmm. And New Orleans is such an amazing place. And I thought, man, I need to come down here and soak this up. I need to come down and soak up Louisiana a little bit. I need to get some of that into my drumming.
And so I told him, well, if you're coming, we're going to get some Lafayette in there too.
Exactly. Exactly. And so so I flew down for a week. And man, it's been a fantastic trip because not only am I getting to play with Jeff almost every night, mm-hmm. but he's introducing me to all these other great musicians, and mm-hmm. it's really been absolutely amazing.
So the soaking in has been positive.
Yes. Yeah, I got to tell this really funny story. So we're doing a sound check at the Open Ears the other night, and I'm trying to learn this New Orleans second line, and I'm just not getting it right. And I'm just like, how do you do it? And Jeff's like, no, try it like this, and he keeps playing me these recordings of all these great New Orleans drummers, and then a brass band starts up on the street and Jeff goes, you know what, Tim, go out on the balcony
yes, it'll
and
be
just
easier.
Listen
just
to these guys to play. So I did, and then I came back, I started playing. He's like, you're getting closer.
Now you have to go out on the street and actually march with them, you know, and dance with them as well.
I think I'll need about 6 months down here. Then that'll really start to soak.
You know, the woman who was in before, she went down to New Orleans from New York, and 17 years later, here she is.
Beautiful.
So. We're gonna suck him in. We'll get him a washboard. He'll
That's
be
right.
all
right. Absolutely.
Well, my wife's from the South, so it will take her no arm twisting to get her to move
That's
down
right.
here. So.
Well, you know, I think what some people listening to us are finding interesting, you all are very young musicians, and I think people associate jazz maybe with an older generation. I mean, a serious interest in jazz. We all know kids play it in high school, you know, for their jazz groups and everything, but to actually dedicate yourself to jazz, I think there are many people listening who would find that quite interesting.
Well, and I think more than jazz specifically, the things that we've dedicated ourselves to is making improvised music that's pertinent to now. The music that expresses where we are right now. And so as a 40-something-year-old guy,
That's young in the world of jazz.
Yeah, it is. You know, well, that's what Tim was telling me on the way over. He got to interview Roy Haynes. And he said, you know, a younger musician gets to interview Roy Haynes. He says, well, as young as I am. I said, man, compared to Roy Haynes, Sonny Rollins is young. You know, so I guess I am young. But to make music that is relevant to our lives, you know, and what Charlie Parker did was really fabulous, and it was relevant in 1945. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But, you know, we probably won't play any Charlie Parker tunes tonight.
All right. So is it all going to be original compositions tonight?
We're going to start with these pieces I composed called the Instigation Quartets. And they're really improvisation instructions. They're text-based pieces. And what it does is it sets up a scenario for us to improvise from, a sort of a starting point. And then we improvise from there. And part of my idea behind structuring the pieces like this, when I first wrote them, I was going to Germany for a week. And it was a group that was assembled just for these performances. And Tobias Delius, a great German saxophonist, was the music director. And he said, bring some music, but realize we're not going to have a lot of rehearsal time. And so I put these together because they're easy to assemble when you're traveling. So if you're traveling by yourself, you can get a band and play them with musicians whom you trust without a lot of rehearsal time. And it really gives space for each musician to be themselves, which is one of the things that excites me about tonight, is I'm really looking forward to hear what Dickie does with these.
That's right. We need to tell people who may just be tuning in. We are speaking with Jeff Albert, Tim Daisy, and Joseph Butts, who will be performing tonight at Cité des Arts, and they will be joined by Dickie Landry on the saxophone.
Which is a real honor for me, because growing up in Lafayette, any of us who were into anything remotely interesting, you know, Dickie was the hero.
So you all knew about him when you were in high school.
I guess we were about 18, and I had a trio with Charlie Wooten and this drummer named Damon Small. And we played, there used to be a place called Café des Artistes on Jefferson, and we had this regular Tuesday night one summer. And one night we were about halfway through the second set, and Charlie leans over and he goes, hey man, Dickie's here. And we all, you know, got nervous for a second. And then he came up on the break, and we're like, oh, he is so cool. So it was completely relaxing, but it was still like, you know, this is the guy who's doing all the stuff that we as kids growing up in Lafayette knew it was possible to go make great, interesting, important music, because Dickie had done it.
Right.
You know,
well,
so.
I love the way you describe that, improvisational music that is relevant to us, pertinent to us. That's a great way to describe that. Well, Joseph, I haven't asked you any questions. I feel like we know you so well here at KRVS. But tell us a bit about how you fit into the mix here. How did you encounter Jeff, and what's your part in this music tonight?
Well, Jeff is actually my teacher at the University of New Orleans. He was running the University of New Orleans big band when I got my master's there.
I forgot that's how we met.
Okay. I mean, I'm pretty sure we might have met once or something before. I can't remember, but he was running the big band when I got there.
And as the bass player, Joe was helping maintain my sanity while I was running the big band, so that was good.
You need a good bass player.
That helps.
I guess I was a staff bass player, student bass player, since
exactly.
There's usually about 300 guitar players and one bassist, and we also did some playing, have done playing since then.
Yeah, Joe's on one of my records that's now out of print, but...
All right. Well, how would you describe Jeff's music? What really attracted you to it?
Well, I mean, I like the freedom aspect and music. It's always a plus when you can put as much as yourself into the music as you can or as is needed. I mean, there's plenty of music where I just, you know, have my part to play, and this is what I'm going to play. It's not going to change. It's going to be the same every gig, and there's a comfort in that, and it's valid. But you know, I need the other stuff.
Well, and the structure of these pieces aren't, you can put as much of yourself in. It's, you sort of have to put yourself in, or they don't work.
Mm-hmm. And I'm also, I mean, I like, I don't, don't like to know exactly what's going to happen all the time in the music. I can check out, you know, and then get sort of distracted by something else other than the music. But if I don't know exactly what's going to happen, I really have to listen and work and think. Play.
Well, you know, if you're putting as much of yourself into this music as you're saying, it's kind of interesting. I'm thinking what Tim said. One of the reasons he wanted to come down here was to soak in Louisiana, to have that experience, to listen to the brass bands.
Absolutely.
You know, so obviously you two have lived in Louisiana, you probably all of your life. Joseph,
the majority
of your life. So you've been soaking in Louisiana a long time compared to Tim, who's just been here a few days. Would a jazz performer listening to you all perform hear Louisiana? I mean, when you say you're putting yourself into it, how much of the place where you're from, the music that you've grown up listening to, the music you've been playing, how much of that informs? Not that you're going to sound like a brass band.
But it's impossible to make that go away.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I've been lucky in New Orleans. I've had a chance to play with George Porter and a lot of the really iconic New Orleans funk and R&B musicians. And so even you go on a freely improvised gig, but if you were on stage with, you know, George Porter and Russell Batiste the night before, like, that groove hasn't left you yet.
It's informing your improvisations, absolutely.
And when the band that I had with Jeb Bishop called Lucky Sevens, when we did our gigs in Chicago, I wrote a tune that was essentially a New Orleans groove, and the drummer in the band was a guy named Quinn Kirchner, who Joe and I have played with quite a bit. And he was living in New Orleans, but was originally from Chicago, ended up back in Chicago. But Quinn really gets the whole New Orleans street beat thing. And we started playing this groove in this club in Chicago, which is a great listening audience. They really get it. But they, like, next thing you knew, people were moving. And you know, so that aspect of getting the audience to be physical with what's happening is something that I really enjoy. And that comes from I think being down here, because so much of what we do is about dancing.
I mean, I think, you know, if you're hearing someone play second line drumming, you know in about 10 seconds whether they've spent any time in New Orleans.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, you can, I mean, if you spent time in New Orleans, you'd hear it.
Mm-hmm. But I think when people hear, you know, contemporary improvisation, jazz, they think of something else, very esoteric, very cerebral perhaps. But when you're talking about actually getting people moving, there's something else that's happening.
Well, I think the mixture of all of those aspects is important. Mm-hmm. I mean, what we do, and who knows what's going to happen tonight, that's part of the fun of this. Mm-hmm. But what we do can be, if you want to over-intellectualize it, I'm sure that you can.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's also possible to just hear it and take it in with an open mind and and let it be cool.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, like with Dickie, you can't remove the farm boy from Cecilia. You know, no matter how many gigs you've played with Philip Glass and where in the world you've been or whatever you've done, like, that's part of you. Mm-hmm. And it's going to come out one way or another.
You know, it's certainly not my idea, but, you know, I've heard it compared that, you know, New Orleans music has more in common with some of the avant-garde and free jazz than some other types of jazz, because there's this different tones you can use and different sounds and rough sounds and... You know, and it's
and
not
the whole collective improvisation.
Collective
idea,
improvisation. And
which is essentially everything we're going to be doing tonight will be collectively improvised, even though there are some formal structures. But
explain what that means, because a lot of people in our audience don't really know musical terms.
Sure. So in a sort of classic jazz setting, if you listen to a Miles Davis record, they'll play the melody, and then Miles will play his solo, and really he's improvising, and what the rhythm section is doing, they react to what he does, but they pretty much have spelled out roles. The bass player walks, the piano player comps the chords. But like in a New Orleans traditional jazz setting, the trumpet player and the clarinet player and the trombone player are sort of all soloing at the same time. It's more of a collective improvisation. So the pieces that we're doing tonight do have some structures in the beginning, like it might say, you know, player one, play a groove, player two, play a melody, like that. But we're improvising them together and finding the spaces as one. And those roles can change over the course of time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so even though Tim's the drummer, like at some point he will get instructions to play the melody, you know, and I'll get instructions to lay down the groove or whatever. Mm-hmm. So those roles change, and part of it keeps us on our toes. And the other thing is, I found if you put people in situations that they aren't expecting, you don't get their standard responses.
Kind of like Tim in Louisiana.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
That they have to deal with it freshly. You can't give the auto response mm-hmm. when the situation is so different.
Right. Now, the two of you know Dickie. You probably played with Dickie. Have you played with him yet?
I have not. Tim. I'm really looking forward to it. I have heard of him, but I've mm-hmm. never played with him. So this mm-hmm. is going to be a lot of fun for me tonight.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
well, that's kind of what you're talking about, putting someone in a situation
absolutely.
That you haven't. So that'll be stretching it. If you have just tuned in, we're talking with the Instigation Quartet, Jeff Albert's Instigation Quartet, which includes him, Dickie Landry tonight, my other guest, Tim Daisy, and Joseph Butts. Tim will be on drums, Joseph on bass, and you'll be trombone?
Trombone,
okay,
yeah.
And then Dickie, of course, on saxophone. Some people may wonder if there's a place they can go to hear some of your music so they could get a sense of what you're talking about.
Sure. JeffAlbert.com mm-hmm. is my website, and there's quite a bit of stuff there. Also, actually, our gig from the other night is not up yet, but there's a series that I run in New Orleans called the Open Ears Music Series, mm-hmm. and that's openearsmusic.org. And there's MP3 archives of years' worth of shows up there, so you can get a good sense. I'm on a good sense for... Actually, there are Instigation Quartet recordings up there of other versions of this band, okay. so that would be a good place
so
to go to hear
Tim,
them.
So, Tim, you joined them on the Open Ears?
He just played Tuesday, yes.
On Tuesday, I did,
in New
yeah.
Orleans.
It was
and,
fantastic.
And it felt good, actually, performing live in
yeah,
New Orleans.
Absolutely. It felt fantastic. Mm-hmm. It was a really, really, really nice night.
Mm-hmm. And what have you done in New Orleans besides playing great music with Jeff that you enjoyed the most?
Eating all the delicious food in the city, taking walks. I had this amazing experience after dinner yesterday where I looked up on this wire and there were all these birds perched on this wire, and I noticed every one of them was a bright yellow parakeet. And that's just something you don't see in Chicago.
Yeah.
So that was really a really nice New Orleans experience.
Parakeets are a little more soot covered.
Yeah, yeah, Chicago, yeah. They're gray and they're walking around collecting garbage.
Frozen.
And, you know, eating garbage off the street. Oh, wait, those are pigeons.
Yeah.
Those are the only birds I see in Chicago. So.
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting, this New Orleans-Chicago connection, because obviously so many early New Orleans musicians ended up in Chicago at one time or another.
Yeah, right.
You know, so they were searching for something different at that point, I guess, audiences, new experiences, and you're kind of doing the reverse migration here for a little bit.
Absolutely, absolutely. And even in more present day, great saxophonist who just passed away fairly recently, Fred Anderson, great Chicago saxophonist, who is somebody that really got me to explore more avant-garde experimental music when I first moved to Chicago. He's had a connection with Kid Jordan in New Orleans for years.
Right. Well, and Fred was born in Louisiana.
And Fred's from Monroe, Louisiana. So all the best musicians come from Louisiana. And some
and
of them
and of that group, the better ones are from Lafayette.
Yeah.
Right. Or there's something akin to that, you know, 6 degrees of separation. It's not.
Right.
They're all connected. Yeah. So Joseph said that you were his teacher in New Orleans. Are you still teaching there?
Yes, I'm not at UNO anymore. Mm-hmm. Actually, I just accepted a full-time position at Loyola in the Music Industry Studies program, teaching, oddly enough, mostly technology classes, software, mixing and mastering and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of have my artistic life and my academic life, and they overlap a little bit.
Right, but. And so are you still teaching students? Like, do you lead any of the bands at Loyola? Or
I'm next year I will lead an ensemble, but it's an ensemble of laptop computers. We have a group called the Electroacoustic Ensemble, and it's all laptops. And we write the software and build our own pieces and our own little crazy joystick-controlled instruments and things.
That's a different kind of instigation.
Yeah,
it's
not quite
that.
Like the UNO Jazz Orchestra.
That's
it's a little
right.
different.
But. Well, maybe you'll bring your group and the laptops up here as well to have
a
show.
Oh, we'd love to.
Somewhere.
That would be great.
Yeah. So people, there's a lot of people interested in jazz in Lafayette and are often lamenting the fact that you can't hear it in Lafayette. You know, there are obviously people like yourselves who love it and have gone off and done things with it, but it's very hard to regularly hear jazz in Lafayette. So I think there must be a lot of people very excited that you all are coming together tonight at Cité to perform. And then there are some people who might be a little, I think I like jazz, but I don't know what to expect tonight. How's it going to be set up and you know... And again, some people might have a character of, they'll be like trapped in this, like, you know, hour and a half long improv.
With no way to get out.
If they get bored, they can come join us. That's okay.
Yeah. Well, how's it going to be
set up? The door will
there?
Remain unlocked during the performance.
Well, people will arrive at Cité. Where are y'all going to be set up?
We're going to be in the back.
In the back part,
in the back,
okay.
On the backstage.
There'll be seats and...
There should be chairs set up, and there will be a stage and a sound system, and, you know, it's not going to be an incredibly elaborate stage, but if you've been back there, it's a nice room to hear music in.
There won't be any tests or anything. There's no previous knowledge required. Everyone is welcome. Yeah.
Just go in here.
You can clap whenever you want.
Yeah. And I'm thinking, too, you know, just as you started in high school, I'm sure all of y'all did, there are a lot of great high school bands around here, jazz groups, and this could be a really good opportunity for them to come and hear what has happened with that interest, you know, that youthful interest in jazz and where it can take them and how it can develop. So great opportunity. I know we have a lot of high school students listening to us at this time right now. Joseph, in fact, brought a great group of kids here to record, and I know they're quite familiar with our studios. Yeah. So high school teachers, students, tonight, 9:30 at Cité des Arts.
And we promise we won't keep you there too late.
Okay. You still know. Have time for homework.
Everybody will be okay to get to work tomorrow.
And again, if you have tuned in, we're talking about a wonderful quartet that will be performing at Cité tonight. The Jeff Albert Instigation Quartet, and that quartet tonight will be Jeff Albert, Dickie Landry, Tim Daisy, who's from Chicago, soaking in Louisiana right now, and Joseph Butts, who is doing marvelous things here in Lafayette, teaching kids and performing all over the place with all kinds of musicians.
Yeah.
And I'm sure bringing that to inform in your improv as well. I think, aren't you with Yvette Landry?
Tomorrow night.
All right. So you can go from the Jeff Albert Instigation Quartet to Yvette Landry tomorrow night.
I can do that.
And hear Joseph Butts and...